My mother's upbringing seemed very dark and bleak. Her mother was not kind, and then was bitter from her life not going the way she wanted and took it out on everyone around her. I don't even know her name. I met her once when I was very little, and I recall my mom being so guarded and stiff around her. It was air you could slice with a knife. That is all I remember. One uncomfortable encounter. However, I was so fond of my grandfather. I knew in my bones that he was a good person. Interesting. A great artist. He was a stained glass maker and he could draw so beautifully. My mother could too. She was amazing. I never dared to draw. It reminded me of her, and yet I think the skills skipped a generation. But I was glad because it differentiated us, although I wonder if my daughters will have that skill. It runs in our family for sure because my grandfather John Barrymore and my great uncle Lionel Barrymore were also great artists. John actually tried to be an artist until the family business of acting just swept him up, but he always felt he didn't get to draw his way to success the way he did on stage. If I see this gift in my girls, I promise to foster it. It is so amazing that someone can put out through their hand what is in their head and make it beautiful at the same time. Sometimes I think I am trying to draw a different picture with my own family in my own way, one where everyone stays in the picture. Although my grandfather Shunny lived across the country, we all made efforts to see each other. He and Marta would come and stay at our West Hollywood duplex for a week or two. I remember he took me to Grauman's Chinese Theater to see my grandfather John Barrymore's hands and feet in the cement with all the other movie stars, except John had put his face in it too, as he was known as the Great Profile. I loved that he was different and had really gone for it. As one grandfather taught me about the other, he also helped with my father. One time Shunny was staying with us, my father had broken in and destroyed our house. He broke all the dishes and ripped things apart, and much worse is that he had taken the hidden spare key. Not wanting him to be able to have access to our home any time he felt like taking out his anger, my grandfather volunteered to get it back from him. A meeting was arranged between the two of them. My dad came screeching around the corner to pick him up. Where my dad got a car was totally dubious, as he didn't own a home or wear shoes and by no means had a car. And he pulled up and we watched my grandfather go out and get into his car, and then it ripped down the street and out of sight. Hours later, the car screeched back into the hood, and we all ran to the window, which was louvered glass slats, and we saw my grandfather get out of the car, obviously drunk to indulge my father, and walk up to the house. The car zipped away again at a crazy speed, and when my grandfather walked in, he composed himself, smiled, and without a word opened his hand. And there was the key. Our next visit, we went to see them out in Pennsylvania. It was my first time seeing snow. One of the things I loved about my grandfather was that he made life interesting. He would explain where snow came from and how it works. He would tell me the functions, and yet nothing lost its poetry. I think my grandfather made me feel like everything was magical. We played in the snow all day, and he gave me peanut M&Ms to give to the squirrels. He looked at me with a glint in his eyes. "They love it," he said. And he was right. They went apeshit for them. His backyard seemed like a tiny little white, icy, powdery world where creatures ate candy and everything was safe and beautiful. I was always calm when I was with him and so sad when I had to leave him, so I was over the moon when my mom pulled together a little cash from the earnings of making E.T. and took us all to Hawaii. It was the first vacation I'd ever been on. I hadn't yet traveled the world for the E.T. press tour because the film had not come out yet. It was 1981, and the last time my life would ever feel simple. We went to the Royal Hawaiian Hotel, which is in Honolulu. The entire hotel is pink. Perfect bubblegum flamingo pink. Like many girls, I have a Pavlovian response to pink, and I just loved it. It was right there on the water, and it seemed like paradise. In fact, it was my introduction to paradise. When we got off the plane, the hot air and smell of flowers immediately transported us. I knew we were in a different place upon landing. It is so open and airy. I couldn't have loved it more. We all set up camp and spent our days on the beach or going to fun kids things like Hanama Bay, a snorkeling bay where there were so many fish you could hold a stack of saltines under the water, and as they disintegrated in your hands, a bunch of fish would swim up and nibble the crackers right out of your fingers. It was a wild sensation, and I couldn't get enough of it. I went home tired. I wished life was like this, and yet I guess that's why they call it vacation. I didn't sleep well at home. I was stressed and an insomniac. That has always been a big telltale sign for me, even to this day. Where do I sleep with peace? Not even in my own bed do I feel that way, just because of daily life worries. But every once in a very blue moon, somewhere will envelop me and literally put me into an easy, deep slumber. And those places feel so special to me, and rare, unfortunately. Hawaii was one of those places. During our days in Hawaii, I loved to walk around the grounds of the hotel. Palm fronds would canopy my journey, and I would find myself going to visit my grandfather in his room. He was always doing something, reading, drawing, writing. He was a thinker. One day I came in and we were talking about the human body, and he was horrified to learn that I didn't know my knee from my ear. I just didn't know how anything functioned or what it was there for. He looked at me. "Do you know why we breathe? Do you know what bones and muscles are? Do you know how we grow hair and why it is only in certain places?" I looked at him. "No, no, and no." I really didn't. No one had ever explained simple or complex workings of anything, not school or any adult. So right then and there, he decided to make me a human body chart. Again, when you can just draw something, you can do anything. And while he was doing that, I sat in a chair enjoying the breeze coming through the window. And then I saw the minibar in the corner and silently crept over to it and opened it. I found a chocolate, and I looked at him with a pleading look. My mother was a vegetarian health nut and never allowed such things. It was the 70s health nut hippie movement, and she was in it. I'm not sure I had ever even had chocolate. I looked at him, he looked at me, and he silently nodded the way he did with the squirrels. He knew it was a treat, and that treats in life were good. I unwrapped it and stared at him. He watched me take a bite as my mind was exploding at the same time. I smiled at him. He smiled at me and then went back to his drawing. I knew he was glad I was experiencing something of pleasure. And in our wordless exchange, I understood so much. He believed people should experience things that make you happy. Maybe that's why he ultimately left his wife. She was said to have been very cold and mean. Maybe he knew that life was short and that feeling good was crucial. Maybe this didn't come easy to him. Maybe it weighed on him very hard at times that he was not able to stay. Maybe he was someone who could recognize joy, and some people cannot, no matter how hard they try. We sat there on this lazy day, an older man and a little girl, and there was nothing wrong, no stress, no worries. I remember these moments well. Not just because I loved him and appreciated him so much, but because easy moments are memorable to me. He finessed the drawing and then took me through anatomy, as he called it, and wrote that word at the top. He had drawn a man and a woman and arrows with descriptions so that I could keep them and use it for any reference. It had so much cool information on it, and it was a simple work of art in itself. I put it in an envelope, and that's where it stayed for the next 20 years. After that trip, Shunny would come out to Los Angeles again when my mother bought our first house in 1983. Life was extremely different, and I had traveled the world, and my mother was taking me to nightclubs, and I was working nonstop. I was different. I don't feel like I spent much time with him, and I have no idea what my mother and his relationship was moving forward because we didn't see him, really. My mother was very private about her relationship with her family and her life, and I was too young to grasp any of it. I was becoming cynical, and I figured nothing lasted at that point in my life. My anger was growing, and I was so confused. The days of sitting in a room at the Royal Hawaiian seemed so far away. Life was sweet then. Now it was confusing and inconsistent. I missed him. I wish we could have spent more time together, but I figured there was a reason for it and that no one was telling me, and I just let the mystery linger. And then one day, I got a phone call. I was now 13 and living at an institution / rehab. My mother just wanted someone to deal with me. My anger had taken over, and I was out of control. And so in the middle of the night, she took me to a place where I went in and the doors locked behind me. I knew that I was not leaving with her. I had gone in and I was not coming back out. A rat, a roach, trapped. So there I lived for 1.5 years. And on one particular day, they said, "You have a phone call." They took me to a back office, which was weird. Normally, you use the pay phones on the wall across from the nurse's station where they could keep an eye on you. So I already knew something was different. I just had no idea what it could be. I picked up a red phone. I remember it was red as if it was yesterday. A Pac Bell push button type of table phone. "Hello," I said. They hadn't even told me who was on the line, so I waited. "Hi." I recognized my mother's voice from those two small letters she uttered. "Your grandfather has died." I didn't respond because I burst into tears. I just sat there crying. I looked around this small, fake wood paneled office, and I saw a few of my counselors just pretending to be busy with their work so as to give me as much privacy and space as they could in this tiny room. It was respectful, and yet I could also see that they had seen it all, done it all. They were all from broken families and were ex-drug addicts, some worse. And now they were trying to help kids who just came from crappy circumstances and needed guidance. It was a Hard Knocks place. No Hollywood bullshit beachside rehab, but a psych ward deep in the valley. No one who was here in this building or here in this office had seen a safe or easy life. It was a place where you accepted that and figured out if you were going to make it or not. Period. I was just another fuck-up dealing with pain. I kept crying, and I kept looking at this red phone that delivered such a blow. As the years passed, I didn't know how to honor him. I have one picture of him, and that's it. It's in a frame, and I look at it all the time. I show it to my daughters, and I tell them about this wonderful man. I wish I could have had more time with him. He was just so amazing. And the only thing that feels within my control is to have my daughters spend as much time as they can with my husband's parents, who are so important to me. And I fight for time with them. I don't have to, really. They are the most loving grandparents you could ever imagine. But I wonder if they will ever know how much I appreciate them. I know they know to some extent. They know how important family is more than I do in so many ways. But I hold on to all of it because it is such a gift. I finally have a family, and I will never, never, never take it for granted. And in those moments where I miss him, if I ever want to visit Shani again, I can transport myself back to that room in that pink hotel with that lovely breeze and my grandfather drawing me a picture. Door number one. When I first met Liza, she intimidated me. My best friend, Robin Fredericks, introduced us, and I would tag along for lunch with them, but our ages were different, so I felt like I didn't totally relate to the conversation. Liza was 10 years older than me, with two daughters, around the ages of 8 and 10 at the time. She was married, mature, but cool. She's like a high-powered executive who's behind a lot of the movies that get nominated for Academy Awards. She has great taste, she is capable, and when I was 28 years old, she just seemed, well, intimidating. But we had a best friend in common, and so I would go to her house for dinner, and there was a great bohemian crowd with a chef and her husband, who you could tell is smart and has great taste for wines. So I would just hold out my glass and try different wines all night. I wasn't married with kids and still had a very long way to go until that was going to take place. Then, years later, Liza and I did a film that she was producing called Big Miracle, a true story about a woman from Greenpeace who set off a chain of events when she tried to save three gray whales in Alaska. The White House, Russia, the oil companies, and global media became involved, and for one moment in time, everyone put down their agendas and actually worked together. It was a very good and compelling story. So Liza and I got to know each other in a different way. I was now 35, single, just back from India, swearing off relationships for a while because I knew that I wanted things to be different. As women, we know that we have a biological window in which we are forced to ask ourselves, do I want to have a family? I knew that no matter what, unless I made big changes in my life, that was not going to happen in the way that I demanded for myself and from myself. If I had grown up at all, I was still young in relationships, a woman in the workplace and yet a kid in love. It was time to reprioritize and sweep the decks, make way for that big, meaningful, life-changing love. And Liza and I would sit around and talk about it. When we first got up to Alaska, I was in my I'm not ready mode. I would say dismissively, I just don't know what's going to happen, but I don't even know what I want to happen. I was exhausted by having spent the majority of my life thinking about someone else, and all of a sudden, I was solo. working in this snow globe-like atmosphere out in the middle of Alaska. After I came back from India, I was reading books again, and I had adopted another dog, Douglas, a nervous mutt with chopstick-like legs, but a good snuggler nonetheless. And I had discovered football and was watching it like mad. It's amazing the things you get to do when you're alone. It's actually really fun. Midway through the film, 2 months later, I had cooled out on the ice floe we shot on every day, literally, and found myself saying to Liza, "You know, being single is great. I don't know why we treat it like some disease we are trying to cure with a remedy of where is he? Because I don't want to know where he is all of a sudden. This is great. I like being alone." She looked at me and smiled. I had really changed my tune since arriving. I was sad and doubtful at first, and now I felt territorial about my space and my life. The film finished, and I had a new sense of self. Something had totally shifted here in this town of Anchorage, and I was really glad. I knew myself in a whole new way, and I actually felt like a complete person for the first time, not defined by someone else. When I left Alaska, I would go to dinner now at Liza's with a new sense of belonging. No, I wasn't married with kids yet, but I wasn't a kid anymore either. I would drink wine with Matthew, Liza's husband, and talk to her other guests with a newfound place in the world. Was this maturity or maybe a sense of calm I simply had never had before? My life had slowed down, and I wasn't being a workaholic, which was very healthy, and I wasn't with a man, so I really only had time to examine myself and become truly comfortable without any distractions. I could feel the next big phase coming. I had met Will Kopelman a few years before, in 2008. We met at a friend's house, and he asked for my phone number, which I loved because I felt like men were not doing that anymore. In a confusion of the sexes in the modern world, women are now often the aggressors, which changed the old world evolutionary courtship of thunking the woman on the head and then dragging her back to the cave, which I was starting to miss because I felt like men thought we didn't want to be pursued anymore. Of course, we had come too far, which I appreciate, and I don't want us to take a step back in time, but I was tired of being the one to make it happen. So when a man asked me for my phone number, I almost fell off the chair. I was thrilled at the old-fashioned question, and I quickly gave it to him. He waited 2 days to call, of course. We had a lovely time dating for a few weeks, and we truly had fun. But fun was all it was because we were both not in the right place at that time. So we just drifted back into our lives and that was that. But it was so nice. And getting to know him was a complete pleasure. But timing is everything. And I could not feel more passionate about that universal clock that you cannot control because it knows better than you about when things are supposed to take place. And in this new place in my life, I was sleeping alone for over a year, finding the middle of the bed and really working on myself. I started to become worried about meeting someone because I was really feeling different than I had ever felt in my life. So strong, and I didn't want anyone to take that away. Someone would have to be the human equivalent of an addition and not a subtraction. Period. It's ironic that we rush through being single as if it's some disease or malady to get rid of or overcome. The truth is, most likely one day you will meet someone and it will be gone. And once it's gone, it's really gone. Why does no one tell us how important it is to enjoy being single and being by yourself? That time is defining and amazing and nothing to cure. It is being alone that will actually set you up the best for being with someone else. Then, one night in 2011, I went out after a function with my business partner, Chris Miller, and since we were all dressed up, we decided to go out and have a nightcap. I was trying to get the attention of the bartender when the man in front of me, whose shoulders I could not see past, though I was hovering anyway, turned around, and I immediately started to apologize for being in his space, and I realized it was Will Kopelman. Oh, hello. I shyly looked down. Something changed right then and there. Here was this cute, nice man who I knew well enough to know he was a good person. The training wheels were off, and all of a sudden, he didn't look like fun. He looked real. Chris looked at me when he turned around and mouthed, "Oh my God." And the feeling in the air was obvious. Will was with his friend, Diana, and Chris and Diana quickly did some kind of recon because Chris walked back over a few minutes later and excitedly whispered in my ear, "He's single." And he smiled at me and sashayed away. Okay, maybe the timing wasn't off anymore. We went on some dates, and they were really fun, but comfortable and without games. There was a goodness there and a shocking trajectory where everything was just falling into place. Being my date to my birthday, meeting the parents, traveling. My friends liked him, which was everything. When I would bring him to functions of mine, I loved that he was classy and could hold intelligent conversations with people and was consistently wonderful. I started to panic. What about my new sense of self? Would that have to go away? Would sharing a life with someone mean I was no longer my own person, but a we? How could I stay one of two rather than becoming half of one? Just like anyone who is about to settle down, I started to examine every little thing. Right around that time, I asked Liza if she and Matthew had any Passover plans. I was trying to take Will to a special place to celebrate it, considering his family was in New York. Thankfully, she welcomed us right in, and off we went for great wine and a great Seder. I just loved the feel of their house. It is intimate, yet lively. Food, cooking, people chatting, familiar faces. I was enveloped by the warmth, which was soothing my pent-up state of having been evaluating how this love with Will could grow and warrant going to the next level. At the age of 36, you don't wait years. You examine the relationship after months so you don't waste years and then find yourself without certain choices. Although I am with men when they want to run away from all the pressure of a woman's biological clock, I get it. Yet this is biology and it's the facts, so when you're thinking about truly being serious with someone, it is serious. You will get back to the fun soon enough, I hoped. Of course, when Liza asked how everything was going, in another classic girl cliche, I spilled it. I said that we were really thinking about getting serious, but how do you know when and how you should get serious, and why does it all feel so serious? She saw the panic in my eyes. She smiled the most cool and knowing smile and laughed and threw her head back and then looked deep into my eyes. She spoke. "Door number one." I looked at her confused. "Excuse me?" I asked her. She said, "Everyone wants to overthink and analyze and take all the fun out of it and freak out. But the truth is, you pick door number one. You choose the great person in front of you, and you don't play the game of let's make a deal and see what's behind door number two, because we are so conditioned to seeing what else is out there." I said, I thought you might have been talking about let's make a deal. That's right, she said. You are so lucky because he's standing right there. She pointed to him, and there he was. My accountable, handsome date who was once again making lovely conversation with my friends. I turned back to her with pride and calmness. He is so wonderful. And he is door number one. And I know it. And he is right here. She smiled and said, and you know what's behind door number two, of course. I looked at her with my questioning eyes and she answered, a donkey and a broken washing machine. So just go. Go and make this work. Will is door number one. And she was right. And I didn't question whether he was the one. I was trying to figure out how I would go all the way with this man and really create that family I have always dreamed of. What Liza was also saying is that there is no room for looking back. You make a choice to commit and you move forward. You live your life and you appreciate what you have. That's it. It's the best advice I ever got. I fell in love. I have two beautiful daughters who are my entire universe and who I live my life for. And if you are lucky enough to get the best opportunity, grab it, hold on to it, and don't let it go. Otherwise, you can get a Kenmore or a Jackass. Door number one. Thank you. Dearest Frankie, you are the most delicious little girl, and this is what I have to say about you so far. When you were born, I had made a playlist for the delivery room. I put Billie Holiday on it and nothing else. It is such soothing music, and when you hear it, you are immediately transported to a timeless, relaxing place. I think that's why so many people put it on during dinner parties, me included. I knew that that calm state of her music was perfect for the mood I wanted to create. And when you were ready to come out into the world, at that very moment, the last song ended and the next one started. It was God Bless the Child. And the whole room started to swoon. We all knew that it could not have been more auspicious. What a miracle. And out you came. And as I lay there waiting to have you put in my arms, before I could even see you, I heard your father say, oh my God, she looks just like you. And of course, I waited to see what he meant. You were put in my arms, and I just held you as if I would never let go. We were finally together. And even though I was so woozy, I just clutched you, making sure you were comfortable and looking at your face, your beautiful little face. Once we were taken into the recovery room, we stayed side by side for the next 4 days. Olive came and brought you a present, a little stuffed bear, and watched you intently. As I took a picture of you meeting each other, I thought to myself, Olive, you must look out for Frankie always. I made sure you had each other. It was a sweet visit, and Olive was at her best. Grammy and Poppy came too. Once again, I held up my old camera and took pictures of everyone holding you. We put all those pictures in frames around the house. I make framed pictures for your father for his birthday, and we have a beautiful collection of pictures and moments in varying sizes all around our home. Something I always admired as a kid in the homes I visited. And now, we have that too. Even though I had only had Olive about a year and a half before, I had forgotten how everything works. But then, it all came back. It's funny how your brain just goes blank, but All the training wheels of fear had come off, and I was trusting that all would be okay this time around. Your temperature and your eyesight and your hearing tests. I knew you would weigh enough. You were such a good tiny baby. You never cried or complained until it was time to eat. And then you would turn beet red in a matter of 2 seconds and you would find your war cry. You went from 0 to 60. And for the girl who was so happy and sweet, you wanted that food now. And then you would retreat back to sweet Frankie with a big burp, which is what I spent my life listening out for, with my ear to your chest, and you were great at it. And it was such a relief to us both. There was never a struggle. You ate like a champ, you slept, and you smiled. And even when you would get a cold, you were nice about it. And as you grew more and more, you put on your weight, right on track. I would watch your blue eyes get bluer and your hair get blonder. You fell in love with the bath. You were over the moon to get on solid foods, as if you had been ready since day one. You got your father's love of food. But your smile. Frankie, you have a billion-dollar smile. You light up like a Christmas tree, and you feel it all the way in the depths of your being. You are joyful, happy, and a stage 5 clinger. You start crying if I leave the room, or put you down, or have to pass you to someone else. We call you rabbit legs because handing you off is like trying to pass a bunny who simply does not want to be handled. And when you are hurt, you throw your arms forward to immediately intertwine them in my arms and clutch me until you calm down. I love it. I love being of service to you. I am always trying new foods. Spaghetti with tomatoes is your absolute favorite, and you can eat an amount of it that starts to worry me. I think about all the flavors to bring to you, but I don't obsess on you to learn every color or animal or number. You like to giggle and laugh with me. We both look at the same thing, like you putting sand in your bag of crackers, and you think it's the funniest thing. And we both do in that moment. We get each other, and it's more about us sharing a sense of humor. At this point, I'd rather have jokes than point out in a book, "This duck is yellow." Although you have discovered books and look at them yourself anyway. Somehow, I just know you will catch up quick, and I don't feel uptight about that because you will have years in school and you are more of a jock at this point anyway. I am convinced you are a drummer. You even hold your sticks perfectly and will adjust them if they have slipped. You have rhythm in both of your arms, and you actually put your whole self into it. It's amazing. I have already enrolled you in music school. You start in the fall. I know that you will grow out of needing to be on my hip or in my arms soon. I can feel it already. You walk and run around, and you have things to do and places to go. You will start to find your autonomy, and there is nothing I can do but support you and cheer you on. Somehow this has gone at the speed of light. And I don't want you to grow too fast, although I will mark another notch soon on the height chart that I have been doing for you and Olive on a wood beam on the wall, the kind I can take and keep if I ever needed to. That's why I did it there. You will start to talk and tell me who you are rather than me just projecting that you love smiling as much as I do. You are good at doing your own thing, but I am always right here. Just don't ever stop needing me. That is what I am here for. You and your sister. To be there every step of the way. I fantasize about the future, and my fantasies are always the same. They are you and your sister feeling like you can always count on me. For the big and the small things and everything in between. I dread the days you will slam the door in my face. I'm not an idiot. I know what having two teenage girls is going to be like. But I can handle it. I was built for this. In fact, I look forward to it. I will always do my best to present the high road in life, teach you to be grateful, polite, and humble. It means everything to me. But you are my teacher too. And so far, you have shown me that to love without end is perfectly safe. My heart grew bigger the day you were born, and it grows bigger every time I see your smile. To say I love you is the understatement of the world. To show you that I do for the rest of my life will be my honor and my pleasure. And as I sing to you in the tune of Rubber Ducky, little Frankie, you're the one. You always make my day so fun. Little Frankie, I'm awfully fond of you. Outward Bound. Nan walked into my office one afternoon in 1998 and said, "Oh my God, they're making Charlie's Angels at Sony. We have to pitch ourselves for it." I was in the middle of shoving cheap sushi in my face, and she was giving me indigestion. I had been so tightly wound on our last film, Never Been Kissed, because vanity deals were dropping like flies, and if your film didn't work, you were done for as a production company. Taking on a giant action movie seemed like enough for me to stop chewing long enough to say with my mouth full, "Okay, tell me everything you know." She said the studio wanted to make the movie, but the big idea was mostly what they were working from, and they were looking for someone to come in and own it and really make it come alive. Then she started talking about how she used to play Charlie's Angels with her friends growing up. They would all be a different angel and go solve cases. Nan looks like an original cast member, and I could picture it perfectly. And eventually, we went in, pitched the movie, and the world we wanted to create, the tone, everything. And wouldn't you know it, they took us two gals on. Then we wanted to hire a first-time director, get a script written with a brilliant writer, and create three characters out of nowhere, convince everyone it would be great, and to trust us, help in the hiring of all the team of costumes, makeup, and production design to set the look of the world, cast Cameron, find our third angel, Lovely Lucy, call a payphone to find Bill Murray at a cryptic location at a set time after flying to New York to stalk him in person just to get him to talk on the phone, wrangle the brilliant Crispin Glover and convince the studio to cast an indie darling as the villain, try to combat all the negativity about how much this movie was going to suck from everyone, including early press and internet whispers, by writing in the first scene of the film that we know we are making another movie out of an old television show, and we are not taking ourselves so seriously, so neither should you. Keep convincing the studio we would not lose their $100 million investment. Crusade for the angels not to use guns, but use their brains in hand-to-hand combat instead. Train kung fu, and then shoot a 5-month-long action film. Then, once it's made, you start working with the team of marketing people and the publicity department trying to figure out how you are going to sell this movie, from the trailers and commercials to posters and a world press tour. And another way to do that is lots and lots of magazine covers. So when Marie Claire suggested that the three angels go to Outward Bound because that would make such a great story to publicize the film, we all went for it. But then I found myself being shipped to Boulder, Utah. At that point, we had just delivered our first cut of the film to the studio, and we were getting a whole bunch of notes. The film was coming out in 3 months, and it was crunch time. We had already been working on it for well over a year, and I was burnt out and stressed. Instead of being a mature and rational person, telling myself that I was lucky to work with all of these incredible people, and no matter what, it's just a movie, I was wondering if all this hard work to have a company was going to crash and burn in a very public and irreversible way. And this company had become so important to me, both professionally and personally. I wanted to be back at home problem solving and not anywhere else. These were my thoughts as we were driving in a van to meet our instructor, who had a giant hat with the word boss written on it. I was standing there as he was telling us we would be driven farther out to a deserted space, dropped off, and picked up in 3 days. We would hike 40 miles, we would not have food, sleeping bags, nothing, just the backpacks we had on our backs. What? What is happening? Where am I? How the fuck did I get myself into this? As we continued in the van, I noticed my fellow angels were nowhere near me. My whole vibe sucked, and as I was stewing in the back, I knew that they had just mutinied to stay away from my toxic energy. Fuck! Cameron and Lucy and I were usually three happy peas in a pod. We loved each other, learned martial arts together, laughed together, pushed and inspired each other. We went to Vegas on weekends together, braided each other's hair together, and yet here I was, ostracized for my bad attitude. I just kept saying, how did I get myself into this? Or, do I want to sell a movie so bad I'm willing to starve and freeze out in the wilderness for it? No response. They weren't playing. They were out to enjoy this. Fuck, fuck, fuck! The van went driving along farther out into where nobody could hear you and nobody cared. The first night we started hiking and I just kept muttering shit under my breath as I trailed everyone. Half because I wanted to just be alone, half because my short little legs couldn't keep up. I was the least athletic of the three of us. I could pretend and train to be a badass. But out here, there was no faking anything. Shit just got way too real for me, and I was pissed. The guide started talking up front about how we would learn to make fire, survive, and find food in these conditions. He started by stopping by a bush and grabbing a hunk of white straw from it and saying, "This is pilu. It's a tree, and people use it in toothpaste and gum, but you can chew on it for hours and get water and saliva from it. It's really pleasant. Pilu is your friend. Make a mental picture and let's find some along on our route." Go fuck yourself. We walked for about 5 miles that night. The terrain looked like dried trees with orange and beige rocks. It looked like the areas you fly over in a plane and think, wow, there's nothing down there but Earth. And if you were to zoom thousands of miles downwards, you would see us making our way through it like tiny little ants. Once the dark had set in, they walked us over to a flat rock that was about 15 by 15 feet and said, "You can all sleep here tonight." I looked at Mr. Boss Hat and thought, are you out of your fucking mind? And then he proceeded to say, "You'll want to huddle together because body warmth is all you have tonight. So the person in the middle is going to get the most heat, but I would rotate all night. It will help." I was going to fucking murder somebody. I knew my dear girlfriends thought I should go suck an egg right now, and no one wanted to spoon with me. But instead, Lucy, raising her hand like a good student, said, "They told me that sleeping in the leaves is good, too." And without showing too much pride from her paying attention at our orientation, he said, "That's right. You can gather leaves and make a pile.
It makes it a little softer and you can even use the leaves as a blanket.
Well, I thought, why wouldn't everyone just do that, you stupid ass? Why are you suggesting this goddamn rock? Everyone said goodnight and dispersed, leaving us to our own devices and to crap in nature, brush teeth, take in the beauty, etc. I just sat there on that rock, mad. I saw Lucy making her leaf bed from the corner of my eye, and I just laid down on the rock telling myself it was temporary. I decided that I would join her there after she fell asleep and wasn't mad that I was enveloping her from behind. As mad as the girls were at me, I think it was sinking in that this was not easy and shit just got real once again. Nighty-night! That chance. Lucy got it from her leaves, freezing and shivering. I need heat! Cameron waved her over and the three of us relented into our three-way spoon. There was no sleep to be had, not 1 minute. All we did was rotate all night like three human skewers on a hibachi. The only person who wasn't dying was the person in the middle. And when your time was up, your time was up. We barely spoke a word. We just knew what we had to do and we did it. When the sun rose, we were happy for some warmth and we roasted ourselves on that rock for at least a half an hour. I heard crunching footsteps and then the boss guy and his cronies approached. Good morning! Who's ready to walk 20 miles? My anger bubbled up all over again. Tired and out of it, we made our way on foot. Again, I was the one bringing up the rear or dragging it down, I'm not sure. Either way, I was back to muttering shit under my breath. I was also so hungry. I hadn't really eaten yesterday traveling, so it felt like 2 days without food at this point, and it was just another thing to tip my scales of sanity versus insanity. I was lopsided and whacked out. All day long, hiking, hiking. Hiking, hiking, stopping for life-saving tips that I absolutely did not listen to. My inner dialogue said, I would rather die out here, or kill me now and do me a favor. And if I ever did get left out in the wilderness again, I probably would die. So there, take that, boss man! We started to have to put carabiners on. We were attached to the guides for safety to make our way down the large boulders and rocks into the little streams and rivers. We would hold our little backpacks over our head as we made our way through the neck-high rivers, and sometimes the backpack would make it out dry and sometimes not. But we were truly in the earth now. If our hike last night was a level 1 or 2, this one was a 9 or 10. This was truly being a part of Mother Nature, and we were slithering through her veins like blood. We got to a large mountaintop, and we all started clipping on to our respective people, again, men who could give us slack and help us get down if we fell, as we were tethered to them in case of emergency. I didn't even know my guy's name, and I am usually the conductor of a group. I am utterly social and usually someone who brings everyone together. In fact, my girlfriends knew me as the producer who made shit happen and was in there smoothing everything over when it needed to be. We all did. We were a team, but I was used to being in some kind of leadership position. Now, I was just dead weight, a carcass being slowly dropped down a chasm. Everyone made his or her way down. Lucy did it brilliantly and got lots of cheers and whoops from the group, like, great job, Lucy! You're like a spider! And they all laughed. And then they yelled, okay, now your turn, Cameron! A born athlete from Long Beach, California, she made her way down like the girl we all know and love. Cool, funny, capable. Everyone roared with delight. Then came a half-hearted to me, okay, now your turn. No name, just a come on, let's get this over with and get the unfun one down the rock. And so I did. And while I was clinging for dear life, my foot slipped and I fell a good 10 feet. And then I snapped with a hard jerk as my tether caught. And I was just swinging in midair back and forth like a stupid metronome in unflattering khakis. Fuck! I screamed. And then the bat was just let out, wailing as the guy just dropped me down the mountain in midair, one embarrassing foot at a time. I just cried and yelled. And by the time my feet feebly reached the ground, my knees buckled and I lay there like a hog-tied loser, all wrapped up in my cords and lines. A few humble and vulnerable hours later, I watched from afar as the whole group bonded. Lucy caught a fish in the river with her bare hands, which she later puked out of her guts. And everyone cooked it and ate it, slapping her back as they feasted. I overheard Cameron saying how great this was. She later got a parasite called Giardia. Wow. Everyone loved them and their team spirit and can-do attitude. What was wrong with me? Why was I so at the end of my rope in every single way? I was seething alone in the bushes, furiously eating pilu because no one would officially talk to me. What was I going through in life? I was 25. Was this my midlife crisis? When you start work at basically 1 and live life in the fastest lane, maybe this was it. I had an enormous amount of stress and no ability to filter it in a healthy way. I would just resort back to being a little girl who was never taught how to handle things. But I don't boo-hoo in life. I pick up the pieces when something goes wrong. I heard myself saying, well, once again, you are going to have to figure things out for yourself. You are here in the bushes for a reason, and you need an epiphany. And first, you need to start eating, licking wounds, and slowly make your way back into everyone's good graces. I wasn't outward bound, but inward spiraling, and I needed to fix this. So I got up, and I walked over to the nature-loving circle and joined the group. I sat a few feet away, just like when a dog has done something really wrong and it worms its way back in slowly. That was me, the dirty little dog. That night, I had softened the girls enough to make my way back into the spoon and we rotated all night. This time we tried the leaves and it was a little better, but it was all about the human burrito, simple as that. The next day, we hiked another several miles and made our way to a beautiful river. They told us we could bathe in there later. But first, we are going to learn to make fire. They took us over to a cave to make a day camp where the wind would be milder. They had us take our sticks and twine and make a bow and arrow type of thing that would be the tool to make the friction to create the spark to start the fire. Then they explained the kindling, how you would go and find something light, wispy, and flammable, and create a little bird's nest with it. You could also take two rocks and rub them together until you create a spark right over your kindling and start your fire that way. Lucy took the two rocks approach while Cameron took the bow friction route. I chose the latter too. Within about 30 minutes, they both had fire and were cheered on accordingly. As far as my encouragement from the guys, I had made my way back into the group over the last 12 hours to warrant a token, keep going, you can do it, type of salute. 3 back-breaking hours later, I still had no fire. My scraped hand was bleeding and I was straining out the last of my tears from yesterday, but quietly so no one could see it. I kept saying to myself, motherfucker, you'll never fucking get this fuck. I kept rubbing, pushing, pulling. I looked like a mad monkey just throwing my arm back and forth trying to create fire. I would not give up.
I was tempted to just turn to everyone and say, you know what? I tried, and I know you're all disappointed I could never accomplish this, so let's just chalk it up to me being the one who doesn't make it out of the wilderness. I could do many other things in life, but this simply wasn't one of them. As I swallowed my defeat and my arm started to slow, I felt sick and ashamed. I was quitting. My arm almost came to a full stop now, just a few disheartened rubs to look like I was doing it rather than actually doing it. Just then, my inner voice really kicked in, and it sounded different from the one that was practicing my excuses for the last few hours. I heard it, the volume turning up like a dial fast. No! You will not give up! You never give up! It doesn't matter what shit you get yourself in, you don't give up! I started working my arm a little faster with each word of militant encouragement. I was my own personal